Iku Iluna, please rise.
Ohea oko eko ka aha, nahe kuyana imua okea aha, ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hana hana okamoko aina o Hawaii. E nai mai, e malio mai, I lohi I a kleo.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
E noho I lalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-468. State of Hawaii, respondent slash plaintiff appellee versus John Singh, petitioner defendant appellant, and Abraham Sionasini, defendant appellee. Arguing for petitioner John Singh, Daniel Kawamoto. Arguing for the respondent, State of Hawaii, Robert Nakatsuji. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, aloha everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. Counsel, are you both ready to proceed? All right. We've allowed 30 minutes for each side for argument today. Mr. Kawamoto, you'll have 25 minutes and we'll give you a warning light with 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal. And Mr. Nakatsuji will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go as well. Mr. Kawamoto, please proceed.
And good morning, may it please the court. Mr. Singh presents two questions that are before this court this morning. The first question is whether or not the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in holding that there was a rational basis to instruct the jury on the included offense of attempted robbery in the second degree. The second issue is whether or not the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in holding that there was sufficient evidence to support a conviction on the issue or on the attempted robbery in the second degree. In addition to those two issues, this court has ordered the parties, and I do want to apologize for the lateness of my reply in that, to answer the question of if the court did err in giving the attempt rob instruction, what relief would Mr. Singh be entitled to? Going to the first question of whether or not the ICA gravely erred in the rational basis question, they did err, and for two reasons. The first reason is more of a general principle. The second reason, more specific to the specific facts of this case. As a general principle, the offense of attempted robbery in the second degree is a non-existent offense. And the reason it's a non-existent offense is because the elements and the way to potentially commit it are exactly identical to what exists in robbery in the second degree. And that's unique because of the way that the robbery statute is written, both 708-841 as well as 708-842 in the course of committing theft. The second point specific to this case, the ICA specifically found that Mr. Singh attempted to exert control over the property of Mr. Mao's watch. And basically, they relied on attempt under HRS 701-109, sub 4, sub 5, as attempt is an included offense of this. And they didn't really go into the analysis on 701-109, sub 5. The rational basis analysis is something they missed.
Counsel, you know, sure. You mentioned that he essentially seems like an impossibility challenge. You're saying that there's no such thing as attempted robbery on the second degree. Now, there's case law here, Mondonca, Tevis, Mason, that have suggested, in fact, have held, that there is attempted robbery as a crime, even though the theft has not been completed and force has not been used. Are you saying those cases are wrong?
The cases that were cited in the state's briefs, the thing about them is the issue in all of those cases was not the issue of whether or not attempted robbery was a valid offense or not. In the Mason case, the issue, that's the most recent case, the 2012 case. It's an ICA unpublished opinion, and the issue in that case was whether or not the court erred in finding, in denying the motion to suppress ID. And it was never brought up on appeal as to whether or not attempted robbery was a valid charge or not. That's actually the only case, I think, of the three where...
What about the guy who was, and I forget which, it might have been the Reese case, the person who was about 75 feet outside the store, and he had the firearm, and there was essentially a conclusion that that attempted robbery in the second degree, or maybe it was first degree, was valid.
And again, in that case, I believe that is the Tevez case where the individual had a shotgun. Again, that question was not brought before the court. I think the Tevez case was about a motion to suppress statements that the individual had made to the police afterwards. So it was. This is really an issue of first impression.
That was actually the Reese case. The guy was outside 75 feet away from the door. He had a rifle in hand. The police pull up, and it was a Miranda right issue. You're right on that. But it was attempted robbery first.
Right.
You said attempted robbery is non-existent. There's never you're saying that's not a charge that can ever be made?
Those cases are a little bit interesting. We don't actually see the charging document on any of those cases except for the Mendonca case. In the Reese and the Tevez opinions, they don't actually include what the charging document's language were. It is included in the Mendonca opinion. That person was specifically charged with attempt to commit theft of property, and it sort of singled it out.
Isn't that the real issue, that in the course of committing robbery, it's the attempted theft?
Right.
So attempt is incorporated into robbery second, and then you need force or the threat of force.
Yes.
What if there's an attempt at using force?
I would consider an attempt at using force to be basically the threat of force. If I were to try to punch a person and miss, I'd have to believe that would be construed as a threat of force.
What if somebody goes into a store, demands money from the cashier, and is trying to pull a gun from their waistband? Drops to the floor, they get spooked and they run out. Would that be attempted robbery?
No, I still think that would be robbery. Because again, even brandishing a weapon, I think, would be...
No, it doesn't come out.
Doesn't come
they
out.
They don't see
all.
It. He tries to grab it. It falls to the ground and he runs out.
I still think that that would be a threat of force, whether or not it's perceived by the individual or not, similar to like a terroristic threatening type of a charge.
What about Mr. Reese, who's standing across the street 75 feet away? There's nothing to indicate anyone saw him with his gun, but isn't that, couldn't one argue that as an attempted use of force? So in other words, I think our questions here relate to the question, can there ever be a crime of attempted robbery? And might there be a distinction based on what it is that's being attempted? Is it the use of force that's being attempted, or is it the theft that's being attempted? Our case here seems to be the theft, relate about the theft, but there could be cases related to the use of force, like Mr. Reese's case.
It is, I suppose, conceivable. I think it would still be difficult. I think the attempted threat of force essentially is the threat of force. That sort of leads me to the second issue or the second point of error for the rational basis analysis in this case, is that unique to this case, Mr. Singh was, the ICA found that it was the attempted theft in this case, and it had nothing to do with the use of force or the attempted use of force or any of the other parts. It has to do with the 708-842 in the course of committing theft. And I think this is where the Mendonca case and the other case potentially get it wrong, is that when you look at the language of in the course of committing theft, it's one block. It has four parts to it, but it's sort of one block. It's attempted theft, to parse it. It's attempted theft, or the commission of theft, the flight from the attempt, or the commission of theft. And it's just incorporated into one block. The state's reply brief, I think, talks about DUI cases and how there are multiple methods of proof in a DUI. The difference is in a DUI, they're parsed out. Like there's 291E61A1, operator assume actual physical control,
under the influence of alcohol to amount sufficient to impair normal mental faculties, ability to care for yourself, conscious capacity. A2, under drugs. A3, 08, breath alcohol level. A4, 08, blood alcohol level. So it's parsed out, and that's why it's different methods of proof in a DUI case, and that's why you can kind of charge them individually.
If I can ask you, in this case, it was indictment for robbery too, right?
And information charge, yes.
And that's what the state was going for. They said, never mind the attempt, we're going for robbery second.
Yes.
And they conceded that the attempt to commit theft is incorporated or subsumed in that robbery two elements.
Yes.
So in your case, you have the attempted theft, trying to grab that watch. You have the use of force. So isn't that robbery second? And he wasn't found guilty of that.
That's correct.
So it's not attempt, it was robbery second.
That's correct. Now, this is the point. In other words,
doesn't the force need to be attempted force, not use of force?
Again, I think the attempted force would qualify as a threat of force. If there's a conceivable
way. Well, let's say it doesn't.
Okay.
Let's assume it doesn't qualify. It's just an attempt. Does that still make it robbery second? Because robbery second talks about use of force or the actual threat of imminent use of force, not attempt. Attempt is only for the theft.
Right. It is, I guess, conceivably possible to
isn't that the plain language, though, of the statute? There's no attempt in any other parts of the elements.
Right.
It's just the theft. So if you have actual use of force or threat, you're in robbery second. Now, if you attempt to use force or you attempt to make the threat, doesn't that get into now attempted robbery?
It can conceivably get there. Again, my position is that those actions would still constitute the threat of force. But that isn't actually Mr. Singh's situation, and I think that's the...
Right. Isn't, if we're talking about attempted use of force and a case that has use of force, does that support an included offense of robbery in the second degree?
And absolutely not. That's, I think, the problem with the rational basis. Under the way that Mr. Singh was charged and under the evidence that was presented, there is no rational basis to acquit on robbery and convict on attempted robbery. And that's what has to be found in order to give the instruction for an included offense, whether or not the included offense conceivably exists or not. So that's sort of the second prong of my argument.
Well, Mr. Kawamoto, if I could ask a question here. So the attempt that you're talking about is simply the attempt to commit theft. You're not considering the possibility of the attempt of the use of force. And it's not just use of force or threat. It's for specific reasons as set forth in the statute, right? So, I mean, you're discounting that possibility given the facts, the evidence in this case?
I think, as a general principle, I believe that the attempted threat of force is the same as a threat of force.
Let's talk about that, okay? And we're talking about 708.841, Section 1B. The person threatens the imminent use of force. Essentially, I'm going to skip a couple of words, right? To compel acquiescence to the taking or escaping the property. In the facts and the evidence of this case, and the punch, the so-called punch by your client is described in varying ways as very light, essentially a 1 on a scale of a 1 to 10. Does that matter here at all as a possible attempt to threaten the use of force for the purpose of escaping?
No, I don't think it does. It is...
Because of the contact?
It is a use of force.
So if he, like you said earlier, if he whiffed, if there was an attempt to strike, but he missed, that might have been an attempt to threaten.
No, I think it would be a threat. If someone were to attempt to punch a person, miss, I have to believe they would perceive that as a threat.
Did your client plead no contest to harassment?
He did, and that was in regards to a police officer that arrested him later.
That had nothing to do with the interval, because it looked like there was about a 1 to 2 minute interval that you point out between the interaction between Mr. Sinonese sorry if I mispronounce his name, but that's not your client, whose name I can pronounce, and Singh's conduct after. What's the impact of this interval to your case and your position that there was use of force?
I think it goes more towards the sufficiency of evidence argument, which is the second point of error that we brought up. The way that 708.842, the commentary describes everything is that the offense of robbery consists of two separate actions. There's basically it's a theft plus an assault. And those two actions need to kind of coexist together for the same purpose. And in this case, the other thing that's interesting is that he was charged with accomplice liability. There's absolutely no evidence that Mr. Singh tried to get the watch, even mentioned the watch, was even aware of the watch. It was zero evidence of that. He didn't talk about it. He didn't ask for it. He didn't say anything about it. It was solely Mr. Sionesini who attempted to grab the watch, failed. And I think that's the critical thing is that after he tried to get the watch and failed, he essentially abandoned his actions. His robbery is now complete. But he then sort of abandons that idea, that goal. A 1 to 2 minute interval passes. And now Mr. Singh comes in and kind of lightly whacks Mr. Mao in the face. And those two actions, Mr. Singh's action is like a separate transaction from Mr. Sionesini's actions. And
the evidence most favorably, in a light most favorable to the government, couldn't you argue that there's a sort of commonality of purpose? They're both right there next to each other. Mr. Singh is watching what the co-defendant is doing, and his statements appear in furtherance of the ultimate objective of getting the watch, arguably. You could argue to the contrary and just say he just randomly wants to hit somebody and say, what, you go call the police. But in context, the state's argument was he was supporting the effort to get the watch. Again, you're talking about sufficiency of the evidence, right?
Right. And the first transaction, and the accomplice thing is important because the jury was instructed on accomplice liability, and I think it's sort of unequivocal that Mr. Sionesini committed the offense of robbery, and he did it. He pled to the charge later on. I think the evidence 100% supports that he is in fact guilty of robbery in the second degree. For the jury to then not come back on a guilty and robbery in the second degree on Mr. Singh suggests to me it has to be the case that they rejected the accomplice liability theory. Otherwise, and it's supported by the facts because.
Should the court have actually given an interrogatory on that? Isn't it usual that a court, then we would know for sure.
Perhaps. And there could be probably a lot of interrogatories that were given. They weren't. And I would argue that it's the duty of the court to do so and not the duty of defense to ask for it. But it wasn't given, so we don't know. Or
they could have believed what you were arguing, that it was a separate action altogether. He had detached from the act of committing the robbery and just assaulted the guy.
Right. And we weren't given, I think I asked for an assault in the third degree instruction that was denied because there's case law that says it's not an included
offense.
Going
back to the statute, though, doesn't it help your argument that robbery second doesn't use the word attempt in relation to use of force or threat of force? Doesn't that help you? Because they tried him on robbery second and they didn't get him on it.
Right. And I think it does help the argument. Again, the facts in this case were not like a mystery when we were going in and when it was pled. Everybody knew that Mr. Mao had not lost his watch. He, in fact, had the watch. He had it in trial. He like held it up and showed it to the jury. It was still with him, and he never lost it, and it was not some new fact or something that nobody knew about.
But there was clearly an attempt to steal it.
By Mr. Sionesini,
which
yes.
Is part of robbery second.
Right. But the fact that the state chose then to charge it as robbery in the second degree sort of acknowledges that they understand that attempted theft is incorporated into it, that any sort of attempted force or any sort of force or anything is all included in the offense.
Well, it doesn't say attempted force in the statute, though. It talks about attempted theft, but not attempted force.
Right. And again, I mean,
I keep saying that, but I don't know where that's coming from.
I think I'm misspeaking. I probably should be saying the threat of force, which is included in the statute.
Which is an actual threat.
Correct.
Not an attempted threat, but an actual threat. And the actual use of force. That's all the statute speaks, does it not?
It is. I would sort of read it like the terroristic threatening statute, where you don't actually have to be threatened. Someone doesn't actually have to be in fear or actually feel a true threat in order for a threat to have been made. And I think that sort of goes to sort of this concept of an attempt. I don't think you can attempt a terroristic threatening either. I think it has to, the action of making some sort of an action or a conduct or whatever satisfies it.
Mr. Kawamoto, what about the state's argument that essentially, given the way in the course of committing a theft is defined, it includes the commission of the theft, and that by the lower court providing instruction on both robbery second and attempted robbery second, it's with the view that the jury could have determined that with regards to commission, there was an attempt. In other words, give the jury two options. And our case law is you can prosecute on two offenses that may apply, but can only convict on one, right? I think that's essentially their argument. How do you respond to that?
And I think that goes back to the rational basis question. Is there a scenario where you can find a person not guilty of the robbery in the second degree on these facts, and then find them guilty on the attempted robbery in the second degree on these facts? And because the attempted theft is included in the language of robbery in the second degree, it cannot happen, or it certainly shouldn't happen. So their argument that you can attach attempt to the theft portion of in the commission of theft, I think falls short for the rational basis analysis, because it can't be done under the whole umbrella of what...
It ignores the other part of that definition.
Correct.
Including attempt. And that assumes the attempt is with regards to the theft, attempt of theft, not the attempt of the other things that we've been talking about, use of force, threat, etc.
Right. It does, because 708-842 specifically is about attempted theft.
Right.
So
could you address the question of in what relief you're seeking? What happens now?
If
you're correct.
The relief we're seeking is a reversal of the conviction. And I think the issue here is double jeopardy. And Mr. Singh is necessarily acquitted of the robbery in the second degree. So if it were to be remanded or something, what would be remanded on? You can't place him back in jeopardy again for an offense that the jury did not find him guilty of, which is the original charge of robbery in the second degree. So the only possible outcome has to be a reversal. I guess the error analysis, I think, is pretty clear in this. If the error is giving the attempt instruction, clearly that influenced the outcome of the case because that was what they convicted on. So under that rubric, the reversal is warranted because the error clearly caused the issue that we're here for today. The double jeopardy question, and I think the McElrath v. Georgia case that recently came out from the U.S. Supreme Court is very instructive on this. It talks about the reason for the acquittal kind of doesn't matter. An acquittal is an acquittal, as the language states. I believe the state in their reply brief essentially concedes this point, that if there is error, a reversal is mandated because of the double jeopardy issue. They kind of go on to, well, what other pipeline remedies or whatever. I don't think that's necessarily important to Mr. Singh. I think for him, it's a question of, is there double jeopardy? And I think the answer is clearly yes. He cannot be re-prosecuted for something that the jury did not find him guilty of on the first go around.
You know, you were saying that attempted robbery is not a crime, it is non-existent. But if we find there is such a thing as attempted robbery, is that making a new rule in your mind?
Is it making a new rule? If I don't think it's a new rule per se, because it would theoretically be applying 701-109 sub 4 sub B and the rational basis analysis in 701-109 sub 5. So it's not a new rule per se. It'd just be an analysis of what is already in existence in regards to how included offenses and attempt work.
Thank you.
Do you think this, you know, given the purpose of the thefts of the, I'm sorry, robbery statute that's sort of reflected in the various commentaries, you know, that suggests there's a desire to have more significant punishment, the threat of both force plus theft as being particularly problematic. I guess what you seem to be arguing is that the legislature intended to have attempt situations covered exclusively by the robbery statute. Is there at least some tension between the purpose of trying to ensure there are effective penalties and having only one path to address this kind of conduct? Or could there be, might one argue, you could also proceed under the attempt statute?
I think by specifically including attempted theft in 708-842, the purpose of the legislature was to sort of have this umbrella catch-all kind of a thing to incorporate all this different type of conduct into robbery, and I think it effectively does. I don't believe that there is a possibility for attempted robbery just because of the way that the robbery statute is created and as it's defined. And that is in comport with the legislature's intent on how they made it. If they wanted to allow the opportunity for attempt, they wouldn't have included attempted theft in 708-42 as part of that language. And I know this court kind of keeps going back to the other aspects of robbery, the force, the threat of force, or even the reckless causing of serious bodily injury. But again, I'll keep kind of going back to this same thing I've been saying, that I think the attempted force would still be the threat of force. And I don't know that there really is a way to kind of realistically say an attempt of a threat is not also just a threat in and of itself, and tying that into the terroristic threatening case law as well. I believe my yellow light is up.
Anything further at this time, or do you want to save your time for rebuttal?
I will save my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Mr. Nakatsuchi.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Honorable Associate Justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court. My name is Robert Nakatsuchi, and I'm a Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for the City and County of Honolulu. It is an honor to appear in front of you today, especially appearing in front of Justice Ginoza and Justice Devens for the first time as members of this court. I would like to note that I'm not a stranger to this court. I have been here before, but this is my first time appearing in front of you in my current capacity, and I'm happy to be here. Your Honor, to me, the central question in this case is how Hawaii courts should address attempt situations in robbery cases. The other issues in this case, the rational basis for the jury instructions, the sufficiency of the evidence, they all flow from that question. And our answer to that question is that under Hawaii's current statutory scheme, the jury has two options. The jury can convict on full robbery based on the portion of the definition of in the course of committing theft that includes attempted theft, or the jury can acquit on full robbery based on the other part of the definition that requires actual commission of the theft, and then convict on the lesser included offense of attempted robbery based on the attempt being a substantial step toward the commission of robbery. And we believe the jury has these options under our statutory scheme. Now, to illustrate what I mean by the jury has two options, let me walk you through what I think the jury did in this case. We are reviewing what the jury did after the fact, and under State versus Bringus, I think what we have to do at this stage is to try to reconcile and harmonize what the jury did in order to come up with a coherent explanation. And if there is a rational way to explain this, then that interpretation should be upheld. And my interpretation is that I believe the jury first considered full robbery, The jury could have focused on the first part of that definition and could have convicted a defendant of full robbery, but instead this jury focused on the second part, the second part that requires actual commission of the theft. And because it was clear in this case that the watch had not actually been taken by the co-defendants, I think the jury had doubts as to whether they could convict on full robbery. This jury, as all juries are, was instructed on reasonable doubt. If they have reasonable doubt on an element of the offense, they're supposed to acquit. And I think what happened here was because the second part of that definition gave them reasonable doubt, they felt that they could not convict on full robbery and had to acquit. This jury was actually doing its job. It was acting very conscientiously. Because they had doubt caused by that portion of the definition.
But doesn't the definition say or?
It does, Your Honor. It does. Yeah. But I think what you have to keep in mind is what the jury's role is in the process. Now, juries, of course, are supposed to resolve disputed facts, but there really weren't disputed facts here. Everybody recognizes that the watch wasn't taken. The judge gives the law in the form of the jury instructions, but the jury then has to take the facts and apply those facts to the law. And here, the jury applied the facts, the watch wasn't taken, applied those facts to the second part of the definition. And the second part yields the result of acquittal. So I think that's what the jury was looking at. That's what they were thinking. They were doing their job.
Can I ask you, I apologize for interrupting, but in the closing argument, the state was arguing for robbery second, and it emphasized that force was used. There was an attempted theft. You folks weren't going for the attempted robbery. You're going for the robbery second.
Yes,
but the fact that force was used, doesn't that take it out of the attempt?
Your Honor, it is true that we were focusing on a conviction of full robbery. So that was what we were arguing. But there was also an instruction on attempt, and that was an option that was given to jurors by our statute.
But if force is actually used, how does that become attempted robbery as opposed to robbery second?
Well, Your Honor, I think what happened here was the jury was not so much focused on the force. The jury was focused on the theft. And because the watch wasn't taken, they felt they couldn't convict on full robbery. Now, I would like to point out, Your Honor, that the defense actually argued something like this in the closing argument. The defense argued that the jury should acquit on full robbery because the watch wasn't taken. So now they're saying, oh, this is irrational, this doesn't make sense. Well, that is what they argued to the jury. It made sense to them, it was rational to them in the closing argument. So I would submit, Your Honors, that—
Did the defense then argue that he should instead be acquitted, convicted on attempt?
Well, Your Honor, They of course argued that he shouldn't be convicted of attempt either.
Right, because they objected to the instruction in the first place, right?
Yes.
What was the rational basis of acquitting on robbery and then instructing on attempted robbery?
Well, Your Honor, I think the circuit court was thinking that something might happen the way it happened here. The jurors focused on the second part of the definition. They acquitted on that basis. And then went to the lesser included offense, the attempt.
But that's wrong. I mean, that's misapplying the law if they did that.
Well, Your Honor.
Because it's or, right?
Your Honor, I think you have to look at the stage of the litigation we're at. We're looking back after the fact at what a jury did. So we have to, we're not supposed to substitute our judgment. Maybe we wouldn't have done this if we were on the jury. Maybe we would have focused on the first part of that definition and convicted a full robbery. But that's not the standard here. Here, we're looking back.
But there was no dispute that force was used. That wasn't the issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't understand how there is a rational basis.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think they were
on robbery and then convicting on attempt under these circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the jury was not focusing on force. I think the jury was focusing on the theft, and because the watch wasn't taken, because the defense actually argued it and invited the jury to rule this way, they acquitted on full robbery. And again, the jury, if they have any doubt, they're supposed to acquit, and they did. But because attempted robbery was an option, they went and considered attempted robbery, and they found no reasonable doubt there. So I think the jury was doing what they were supposed to do as best they could. Maybe we wouldn't do it if we were the jury, but they were doing the best they could. And in this case, Your Honor, I think, again, you have to look at it based on where we are now. We have to reconcile, we have to harmonize what the jury did. If we can find any reasonable way of explaining it in a coherent manner, we have to uphold what they did. And what I'm trying to present to you is an explanation.
Let me ask you this. You know, I think what I gather from some of the questions is you need an attempted theft, watch was not taken, plus the use of force. And how is that not robbery in the second degree?
Well, Your Honor, again, it's not robbery if the jury focuses on the part of the definition that requires a committed robbery, or committed theft, rather. And they did. They apparently did what the defense asked them to do. They noticed that the watch wasn't taken. They acquitted on full robbery because of that. And Your
coming
Honor,
back to Justice Devens's point, you know, the state made exactly the opposite argument, and the state said the state's position is the defendant is guilty as charged, not of the included offense of attempted robbery, but as charged of robbery in the second degree, because when you dissect the instructions, you will see that the attempt and the flight are built into the definition of robbery in the second degree. So the state made exactly this argument, or in essence, the argument that the defense is making now.
Well, Your Honor, we did argue in favor of convicting of full robbery. We did argue that. And as I've argued, that is an option that the jury has. The jury could focus on the first part of the definition. The first part addresses attempted theft, and they could have convicted on the first part. This jury, though, didn't. This jury instead focused on the second part. They were bothered by it. It gave them reasonable doubt, and they did their duty.
The defense indicates that they requested an instruction on assault third, and the state objected. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I got this case on cert, so...
You should know the record.
Yes, Your Honor, but I'm not that familiar with the record. I'm sorry.
What exactly are you saying we should do? What exactly is your theory? I mean, I went back and looked at the answering brief, and the argument there was, well, the jury pretty much found, you know, the jury convicted him of attempted robbery, and in doing so, they found all the things that they would have needed to find in order to convict him of robbery under the theory that it was attempt, so no harm, no foul. Is that what you're arguing today, or what exactly is the theory that you're arguing for, I assume, to affirm the conviction, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, my argument today is that this court should not change Hawaii law. This court should maintain Hawaii law as it is, and under current Hawaii law, what the jury and the circuit court did here was correct. They instructed according to what the law is, and I would ask the court not to change Hawaii law and affirm the conviction. Now, I realize that this court...
Hawaii law currently says that Hawaii law does say that you give a lesser included if there's a rational basis for acquitting, and then of convicting on an included offense. And I'm still having a lot of trouble understanding how there was a rational basis here.
Well, Your Honor, the rational basis is they acquitted by focusing on the second part of the definition. And again, we have to interpret this looking back. You know, this is not what we would have done as jurors. This is looking back and trying to make sense of what the jury did. And I think if you do that, what the jury did does make sense.
Aren't we supposed to decide whether the court instructed the jury properly? Is that part of the inquiry? I'm trying to get my head around this notion that we're trying to somehow piece together a rational explanation for what the jury did, as opposed to whether the court properly instructed the jury or not based on what the record showed as of the time of giving the instruction. And the test there, as Justice McKenna suggests, is there's a rational basis for acquitting of the greater and in instructing on the lesser.
Well, yes, Your Honor. I think that in this case, there was a rational basis. I think the judge has to decide if it's possible for the jury to do this. And as I've explained, I think it was possible for the jury to do this. And it's actually consistent with what the defense argued in the closing argument.
But isn't your real problem that it's an undisputed fact that force was used? You know, how do you get around that to get to attempt? That's what I'm struggling with.
Well, Your Honor,
And regardless of trying to second guess what the jury said, the instruction itself, if you have undisputed force was used, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is robbery second, not attempted.
Yes, Your Honor. But I think, again, the jury wasn't focused on force. Again, it was undisputed. So
then they may have been misfocused.
I think they were focused on the second part, which requires a commission of theft. And that's where you get attempted theft. Now, I realize
that if force is used, would you agree that attempted robbery would not fit? If force was actually used, it would not be attempted robbery?
Well, Your Honor, if force was used, then we wouldn't be considering attempted robbery based on an attempted use of force. Okay?
Right. If force was used, it would not be attempted robbery. Do you agree with that?
If the attempt is based on a force theory. Here, though, I think the question was the attempt on the theft.
Which is part of robbery, too, the definition.
Yes, Your Honor. It's one of the options that we believe the jury has. However, we think the jury has a second option. We think they could acquit on the commission of theft part, the actual commission of theft, and then go to attempted robbery.
Was there any dispute that force may not have been used?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think Mr. Sionicini tried to take the watch. I don't think that's disputed at all.
Or the punch.
Yes, and Mr. Singh punched Mr. Mao.
There was no dispute on that part.
I don't think there's any dispute. Now, again, Your Honors, I realize that you may disagree with my arguments here. If you do, and you do want to change Hawaii law, and you want to limit conviction of an attempt situation to full robbery, I'd ask the court to apply the new rule prospectively only.
I don't think that's what we're saying. I think what we're saying is, under the facts of this case, how could there be an attempted robbery?
Your Honor, again, I've explained that I think there are two ways of addressing this. And if this court does disagree and wants to limit that, then I think any rule change should be prospective only. Because, you know, Your Honor, I think if you do what defendant is requesting, I think it's really going to cause a lot of problems. For one thing, there's the problem of possible Rule 40 petitions. I think it'll cast doubt on any person who's been convicted of attempted robbery for decades.
What would the new rule be? What are you referring to?
Well, Your Honor, if the defense's argument that attempted robbery just doesn't exist, you know, I think all of those prior convictions of attempted robbery.
What if we don't so hold?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What if we don't hold that there's no way you can ever have attempted robbery?
That would be great. Then at least, you know, we'd have a chance to avoid Rule 40 petitions. Furthermore, Your Honor, there's a problem here with what to do with the defendant and similarly situated defendants. There's a problem. You know, I don't think we can retry on full robbery, having been acquitted. And
I wish we knew whether or not the defendant had actually requested assault third and the state objected. The state chooses its charges, right? I mean, the state didn't charge assault third here, right? There's pretty clearly an assault third here, right?
I assume the court, the state could have charged assault third, but again, Your Honor, we're here looking at robbery, trying to figure out how to deal with an attempt situation in a robbery case. And we just asked the court to, if you are going to change Hawaii law, do so only prospectively. Again, Your Honor, there's been a lot of reliance on those prior cases. And I think in changing Hawaii law, I think you create all kinds of problems, including—
If we're not changing the law, would you agree it would amount to double jeopardy to try Mr. Singh again?
Your Honor, I think the problem is he was acquitted of full robbery, and according to the U.S. Supreme Court, an acquittal is an acquittal. As for attempted robbery, if you agree with the defense, then attempted robbery won't exist, in which case we can't retry him for attempted robbery. So we're stuck. This is catch 22. We can't retry him. And that's flatly contradictory to the legislative intent. I think it's very clear that the legislature wanted to punish use of force in the commission of theft, even if the theft wasn't completed.
Well, I don't think anybody disagrees with that, because that's part of the robbery two definition.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't think anyone's really arguing
against that. Your Honor. And the legislature has provided two ways of addressing this. And I think this court has to ask itself, if it's going to change the law, what is its authority for changing the statute? Basically, what defense wants you to do is rewrite the statute. And
Mr. Nakatsuji, applying the facts, though, and the evidence in this case to the statute, and where the definition of in the course of committing a theft includes the attempt to commit a theft, I mean, just applying the facts of this case to the statute is not changing the law, right? I mean, you're not saying we're obligated to say we're changing the law by simply applying the evidence that was presented in this case.
Well, Your Honor, I would ask the court not to change the law. And if there's a way to do that would be great. But from what I'm hearing from the defense, it does seem like they're saying the only way that you can deal with an attempt situation is by conviction of full robbery. And if that's so, that is a change in the law, because that's not what State versus Mason says. And I think Mendonca also is probably the same situation.
I think I heard Mr. Kawamoto say basically to this issue, it's not of much concern to his client. I mean, his client is more concerned with his conviction. But, you know, we'll let Mr. Kawamoto address that when he comes back up. I just want to be clear. The state's position is there was no attempt to use force. There was, in fact, use of force. And in my view, the use of force is the co-defendant. It's not Mr. Singh's use of force, because the use of force under the statute is with the intent to overcome that person's physical resistance or physical power of resistance. At the time Mr. Singh used force, there was no effort by the complaining witness to resist at 1 or 2 minutes after the first incident, right? I mean, so in any event, there's no argument by the state there's an attempt to use force, right?
Your Honor, I think that what happened here was Mr. Sionesini used the force, and then Mr. Singh aided and abetted him by using additional force. So, you know, there was an accomplice jury instruction here.
Okay,
and
no attempt, though. Yes, there was actual use of force.
So Mr. Singh, basically together, Mr. Singh and Mr. Sionesini were trying to take the watch.
And no threat. With regards to the effort to escape. The state's position is the only attempt was the attempt to commit the theft.
It looks like that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. You know, shifting back to that, let's just go to the substantial evidence point. I mean, what about that 1 to 2 minute interval? Didn't that sort of change the landscape of the theft?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what happened here was... you know, if you look at the testimony, Mr. Singh and Mr. Sionesini arrived together. They came to the scene together. When Mr. Sionesini was trying to grab the watch, Mr. Singh was right there. And then they left
now
together.
That's not a crime being right there, right?
Yes,
so it's only later.
Yes. But again, their entire behavior indicates that they were together. And I think, you know, Mr. Kawamoto makes valiant efforts to try to separate them, but ultimately, the jury didn't believe it. And, you know, the question here now is, was there substantial evidence for the jury to believe that they were together? And I think there was. So
wasn't the state also, the state also arguing that the use of force was to aid in the flight?
Possibly, wasn't that part of the argument?
The walk to the ebb tide.
I think the focus of the state's argument was on the attempt to take the watch. So I don't think it was focused on the flight. But I could be wrong.
I thought they were trying to tie the punch to aiding the flight.
It's possible.
That's what the closing argument seemed to be alluding to.
Your Honor, it is possible that they argued that. But in my mind, I think they were focused on the attempt and the fact that the watch wasn't taken.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd just like to reiterate, we'd ask the court not to change Hawaii law, to affirm the convictions, because in our view, the judge and the jury in this case, they acted entirely consistently with Hawaii law. The instructions tracked Hawaii law. And if you are going to depart from Hawaii law, contrary to those cases, Mendonca, Mason, and all of those cases, If you do depart from Hawaii law, we'd ask the court to consider the consequences and apply cases like Levy and Jess and do so only prospectively, because that solves a lot of problems. In closing, Your Honor, if the court has no further questions, I would like to say that this case, it's a very interesting case. It's almost like a bar exam question or a final in a law school course. But I'd ask the court not to take an academic approach on this. This is real life. These are real convictions. We're dealing with convictions of attempted robbery stretching back decades. And I'd ask the court to really keep that in mind. And instead of kind of addressing this kind of as an academic problem, keep in mind this is the real world. And use your knowledge and experience, your abundant experience, to make a wise decision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Kawamoto, your rebuttal.
The impression I'm getting is that the court is a little bit hesitant to find that attempted robbery cannot exist in any way, shape, or form. But for the first thing, it's not necessary for Mr. King or Mr. Singh's case to reverse, even if the court does believe that there are ways that attempted robbery can occur. What I think is kind of unequivocal, though, is that attempt robbery is impossible for the 708-842 aspect in the commission of theft. Whether or not it can occur for the use of force, threat of force, that sort of aspect is sort of a separate question, but it certainly cannot occur under the 708-842 in the commission of theft definition just because of the way it's defined. And because that's the factual issue in Mr. Singh's case, I don't know that the court needs to make any new law or make any new rulings or anything like that. It's just when you focus on the facts of Mr. Singh's situation, attempted robbery cannot exist under 708-842. Whether or not it exists for something else, it's not really a question at bar. When we talk about the rational basis analysis, that's the critical thing, is that the attempt robbery that Mr. Singh was convicted of shouldn't have been given as an instruction because there wasn't a rational basis. So I think when the state is saying the jury could look at it and just sort of cut out one part of in the commission of theft and focus on that part and apply attempted theft to that part and it gets to this conclusion and that's fine, it's not fine, because they shouldn't have been given the option of attempted robbery in the second degree because there was no
rational basis. Is there something in the record that indicates that you did request an assault third instruction?
I want to say I requested it orally.
During the jury instruction settlement
during
conference,
the jury instruction
and we don't settlement. Have that transcript?
The transcript is, I think
there are jury instruction settlement conference, not the giving of the jury instructions.
Yes, that's possible. At any rate, I think there's ample case law that says it's actually not an included offense because it requires an additional element of pain and not simply force. And frankly, in this case, I'm not even convinced that Mr. Mao, that there was an assault three as opposed to like a harassment because of the 1 out of 10 pain that he said he felt. And I believe I tried to clarify that in trial and he kind of just reiterated it was
It seemed pretty ambiguous as to whether or not he suffered any pain or not. He was minimizing it, obviously, from what I read.
Yeah, and that was sort of his stance all along, is he just kind of kept describing it as a 1 out of 10 and he wouldn't really say if that was actually pain or not. I don't think that matters.
Well, I didn't know what one meant. It wasn't 0 to 10, it was 1 to 10.
Right.
You say 0, no pain. And I think someone made an argument on that.
Yeah, it's sort of unclear. I think it's clear that it's force, whether or not assault three or not.
Yeah, what is a gloss punch anyway? A gloss punch. So I think the definition of a punch is a little bit more than one anyway, but I guess that doesn't matter.
Right. I think it's clear that there was force. Getting to kind of the the sufficiency of evidence part, I mean, when we're talking about that 1 to 2 minute time gap, there's two instances of force in this case. There's Mr. Sionesini's force of attempting to actually take the watch, and then there's Mr. Singh's force of the glossed punch that occurs 1 to 2 minutes after. And again, for sufficiency purposes, that 1 to 2 minute time gap is wildly important because it creates two separate transactions, and I see my time is up.
Anything further to wrap up for the court?
Nothing further, thank you so much.
Very well, thank you very much for your arguments to both of our counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Iku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku ia mai ne ke aha ho'okolo kolo ki eke hanohano o aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned. Thank you.